It's very late at night. It's, in fact, nearly the next day. Which day? I don't know if I should tell you. I'd like this to be timeless because I've travelled a long way. I've come all the way to Bristol, which is quite a hike for me. Especially as none of you gits out there are clicking the donate button and funding me. It all comes out of my own pocket, remember, but I'm quite excited to be in Bristol because for a while now I've been meaning to come and see Tony Gosling, who is a freelance journalist who has done an incredible amount of research on a subject that I'd like him to talk about right now, and I might stick in a question occasionally because we're getting very close to a yearly meeting held by a certain organisation called the Bilderberg Group. Tony, thank you very much for sparing the time. I know you've got an incredibly busy day tomorrow.
Yeah, the Bilderbergs are an interesting organisation. I was working as a reporter for the BBC. I'd worked as a researcher and reporter back in the early 90s. And after I left, I was doing environmental campaigning and this kind of thing, working for and with a group called The Land Is Ours, which is a British land rights campaign, you know, basically trying to get access to land for people to live on, access to walk on, all this kind of stuff. And one of the pieces of land we occupied in London back in 1996, next to Wandsworth Bridge, and built an eco-village on. This was some derelict land there where there was going to be a supermarket built, which we managed to stop with the protest. And we arrived to help out a small local campaign that had been trying to stop this supermarket. One sunny summer's day in 96, someone came to visit the site, who'd seen some stuff about it on the local news, and he started talking to me about this organisation called the Bilderbergs. Oh yeah, this all the land question, you're absolutely right, it's very important that the land question is sorted out. But what about the money question? These people run the world's money. They're a secret organisation called the Bilderbergs. Now, I looked at the guy as if he was some kind of nutcase. I thought, what on earth is this guy talking about? But dutifully, I scribbled down some of the details, these accusations he made. When I got back to the office in Oxford, we happened to have access to the Reuters database of articles. So I plugged this word Bilderberg into the database, and lo and behold, out came these very confidential sounding press releases. Now, you don't normally expect a press release to be marked confidential, and it actually said on the press release, this is confidential. Are you thinking to yourself, well, what on earth is this all about? So I looked a little bit further, and it was a meeting with a list of names of really some of the richest and most powerful people on earth, including royalty. And I thought to myself, well, this is a bit strange. You know, how come no one seems to have heard of this organisation? So anyway, I did the thing, the most obvious thing to do at the time, which was grab some of this information and then just, sort of cut and pasted it into a web page and published it on the internet. And that's really how the Bilderberg website began. Well, it's now, at the time, it was a small website. But then I was chatting with a friend of mine who's the... actually, funnily enough, her sister's goddaughter of Henry Kissinger. And she was quite concerned about this Bilderberg organisation as well. And I was absolutely stony broke at the time. So she coughed up the money to host a website for a year and to pay for the domain name Bilderberg.org. So that's where it's been ever since, really, for the last 10 years or so. You know, the more I find out about it, the more dodgy it seems. First of all, that there's so little consciousness around the world of the power of these individuals, but also the incredible stories that come out of these meetings. They have an incredible power of patronage. It does seem that every major leader in the Western world goes to a Bilderberg meeting before they become prime minister, before they get to a position of power. So the way I describe it is that Bilderberg has this kind of magic wand of power that they would say that, well, we're very good at identifying up-and-coming talent. I would say that they're basically interviewing people that they want to propel into the top positions in society.
What kind of people do you find at these meetings?
Well, the list of names really, they do issue a list which is supposed to be confidential at each meeting. The list of names really goes through the most powerful people on Earth. That is, starting with the banks. I mean, we've got the Federal Reserve, the boss of the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, which is a private bank which controls the dollar. We've also got the chief of the European Central Bank and all of the major sort of international financial architecture, the IMF and the World Bank. These bosses are there. Then you've got the big corporations, most powerful corporations on Earth, the big owners of massive public utilities like Société Générale de Belgique, who also got lots of other big interests. A lot of these names people haven't heard of, but they are some of the biggest companies on Earth. Then oil companies, the big oil companies, people like Royal Dutch Shell and BP. And then, of course, we're getting into the royal family, right? The Dutch royal family, the British royal family, and other European royal families that go to these meetings. So, I mean, there have been a few since, I mean, we're really talking about since the mid-90s, a few things like television documentaries and small exposés on them. One of the most famous is by John Ronson, who was a Guardian columnist. He did a programme about the Bilderbergs as part of his series on Channel 4, The Secret Rulers of the World. And John Ronson went to the 1999 Bilderberg Conference in Portugal. And he got followed, and they had all sorts of weird things happening, like people going into his hotel room to check out all his equipment and this kind of thing. So he was aware. He actually, I think John did a really good job, in that he went into the situation with an open mind. Very few documentary makers do that. He went in sort of not really sure whether this was a massive conspiracy or whether it was just an innocent private meeting. And so, as you see through the documentary, he's kind of swaying between one side and another. One minute he thinks, yes, this is all a load of bunkum and these people are just a bunch of mates having a chat. The next minute he realises that stuff in his room has been moved, and he's thinking, hang on a minute, I'm under some sort of full-on surveillance here. And he kind of finishes up with the conclusion that, well, maybe these people, you know, you might think that they do rule the world from behind the scenes, but actually, really, the power of money rules the world, and not the Bilderbergers. So really, they are trying to kind of, if you want, surf a kind of financial, economic situation. But I would argue that if you have a look at the amount of the big financial institutions that are in that single conference, actually the Bilderberg do control the money. They decide interest rates, they decide, and actually, you know, bankers do have a tremendous amount of discretion when it comes to when they're lending people money. This is the power that these bankers have. And I think this isn't really something that most of the public are really aware of, how much discretion and how much power these bankers have. So when John's saying that actually the power of money rules the world, well, these guys rule the money power. And if you're looking at the sort of the interconnectedness with the politicians, there's many politicians, high-ranking politicians and leaders of opposition parties that may soon become leaders, prime ministers, this kind of thing are there. There's a tremendous amount of political and economic power concentrated in the same place at the same time.
I know that some of the larger names, Donald Rumsfeld has actually been to a few meetings. Now that he seems to be a little bit, whether it's fake or not, out of favour, do you think he'll be there at this year's meeting?
When they release their official list, no one's really sure whether they're telling the truth. So, one of the things I can tell you, I mean, I've been to two Bilderberg conferences personally and you know, been actually there on the scene to see what happens. And you can see that there are some cars that arrive kind of around the back of the conference or in total secrecy, blacked out windows, and you can't see who's getting in and who's getting out. So there's clearly some people coming to this conference who aren't on the list and who the organisers definitely don't want any journalists or anybody knowing that they're actually there. So there's this sort of flexibility as who may be there. But then also, there are different categories of people that go. So there is a steering group, which is made up of about 10 or 15 of the key people. And they meet as when the Bilderberg Conference starts, wherever it is in North America or Europe. There's a whole bunch of people turn up 3 or 4 hours earlier to have a steering group meeting before the main part of the conference. These people are people like David Rockefeller, the chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, who's the inheritor of the Standard Oil, John Rockefeller's oil fortune. And so there's Rockefeller. There's another big figure in it is Henry Kissinger. I mean, he's one of the main, most powerful political figures involved. And this really we should be worried about, because Kissinger is a man who's, there's many records of his involvement in extremely, what would be really illegal under international war activities, really ever since the end of his premiership in the States as Secretary of State under Nixon. And ever since then, Kissinger is smitten with this thing of power, I think, where he was in a position of power in those days. But it's one of those things he can't give up. When he finished as Secretary of State, he set up an organisation called Kissinger Associates, who are a secretive but very rich and very powerful international kind of troubleshooter consultant firm. So, for example, if you're the president of, let's say, Ghana, and you're having incursions across your border, well, you can go and have a chat to the United Nations and they'll do nothing about it. You can have a chat to the Security Council and they'll do nothing about it. But Kissinger Associates are the company that will help sort the situation out. So for a minimum of $1 million, Kissinger will have a chat to you on the phone and see if he can have a chat to some contacts to get your situation sorted out. Now, this all almost sounds like something from a kind of weird Boyzone or science fiction film, but I can assure you this is the kind of thing that goes on. I mean, it's well known, and there's the Hitchens book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, that he was the man behind the coup in Chile in the 70s, where a democratically elected President Allende, who was a left-wing leader, Kissinger decided, and the American CIA and the American establishment has decided that they didn't want a left-wing government in the Americas. And so Kissinger organized the assassination of the Democratic general who was really making sure that the election was upheld. And this is all really well documented. So, you know, there was also loads of stuff to do with Kissinger involved in the fascist takeover in Indonesia, in the terrible debacle over Cyprus between the Turks and the Greeks. All these major conflicts, it seems. So at some point, I mean, even the business with the African nations like Zimbabwe, Kissinger was involved, you know, in so many of these really stitch-ups by the West of democratic countries around the world, that we should be really concerned that this man is a central figure in this organisation. And I think it is really impossible to trust any statement that comes out of the organisation.
So when they do make a statement, what do they actually say that they are doing in this meeting?
Well, they make a very bland, benign list of the subjects which are being covered. I mean, they will obviously be talking about the situation with Iran. They will be most concerned about the rise of, Iran's nuclear capabilities and this kind of thing. But they won't really be concerned that if they are acting on those. I mean, for example, in Iraq, they don't seem to be concerned about the trouble that is caused by these massive international interventions. And if you have a look at the countries that in which Bilderberg operates, because it really excludes most of the world, it's just Western Europe and North America, really the NATO countries, and it's not just prime ministers who are selected by Bilderberg or interviewed by Bilderberg, I would say it's also the NATO secretaries general. So there's a very heavy military side to it as well as a financial side. So the leaks that come out from the meetings, last year, for example, there was obviously big discussion about Iran, but one of the most telling examples was back in 2002, and leaks were coming out about Iraq, and this was actually one of the first times I ever heard that there was going to be a serious attempt to actually overthrow Saddam, was leaks from that Bilderberg conference. Now, it does seem that many of the troubles that we have in the world today have originated from these people. So we have to ask questions about, you know, what is going on in these meetings. And I think it's absolutely crucial that there's some kind of press scrutiny at every level.
Is there any connection between the Bilderberg Group and PNAC, the Project for a New American Century?
Well, it almost seems like the Bilderberg are there implementing policies that have been put together by the neoconservatives, by the Project for the New American Century. Because if you look at some of the people involved in PNAC, the sort of the nightmare people who have inspired this drive for a kind of world domination by as America is kind of reaching the end of its dominance, it seems that it is trying to, and it starts to become financially crippled by massive debt, it's trying to assert itself on the world. It's like the last throes of a dying empire. And the Bilderberg conferences seem to be very much focused on the policy, American foreign policy objectives of the Project for the New American Century, and the neoconservatives. One of the most well-known neoconservatives, Richard Perle, was photographing the cars as they were going into a conference, and suddenly recognised Perle because there was a bit of a queue for the security checks, and you could see he was kind of didn't really want to be photographed, but I filmed him through the window. So Richard Perle is one of the people that goes to these meetings. He was the American Defense Policy Staff, I think. He was a chairman of... and that was in the run-up to the Iraq War. So these are key people who are to blame for the massive slaughter, the racist hate that there is at the moment against Islamic nations, and for what is now between 700,000 and 800,000 civilian casualties in Iraq. This is no small number of people. And when we're starting to talk about, you know, actually exceeding the number of civilian casualties in World War II. So, that what's happened in the Middle East is really, I see it as a completely different to the wars we've known in the past. It's not really a war. It's just the military being used to slaughter civilians. And I think this is actually part of their plan, is that it's not something that most people want to think about, want to stomach. How could there be an organisation which is so clandestine that has so much power? And of course, this is a sort of almost like a psychological trick. Because people don't want to believe it, it makes it that much more difficult for anyone to really go there. And, it's almost as if the worse that this organisation can be, the less people want to actually scrutinise it. It's certainly true that much of the world's most powerful media corporations, and there really are only five big, powerful corporations, obviously News International, there are several others, in the world. And many of these people are actually, their chief executive will actually be at the Bilderberg conference itself, including even BBC governors going to these conferences. So, as I said, there is a steering group in the middle, but most of the people that actually attend the meeting are basically there to be persuaded and also to contribute to the discussion, to be on side the expansion of the US empire around the world.
Where is the power base actually rooted? Does it belong to a particular country, or is it this group of individuals? Because I know the Bilderberg's head office is in Holland, is that right?
Yeah, this is one of the curious things about it. Yeah, I think, if you're looking at the wealth from Bilderberg, I don't think it's in any one particular country. I think that if you look across, particularly across the Western world, because, for example, the big powerhouses of the Far East, like Japan and places like that, aren't represented here at all. And I think, there's, and the same is true with Russia, is there is no representation of them in these meetings, which is, it seems very strange to me that if there are plans being made for the economic and military future of the world, that any organisation wouldn't want to have major powers of the world involved. That actually is incredibly divisive. If these meetings are, as powerful as they seem, to exclude large, powerful areas of the world seems totally irresponsible and actually designed to create conflict. And this is one of the things that frightens me about this, you know, and it's why I think there should be pressure, and I, you know, do in my small way, put some pressure on them to actually to be more open. Because what they say is that they're creating some kind of consensus in these meetings, and of course they're not really. What they're doing is they're stuffing the meetings with people who are neoconservatives and on board this whole idea of military US expansionism around the world.
Is that what you think is the ultimate goal of the Bilderberg Group? Do they have an ultimate goal?
Well, it's really difficult to tell what that is. But it does seem to be right now. I mean, the group only started in 1954, after the Second World War. It was started by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was, just before the war, he was in the SS. You know, he enrolled in the SS as part of Nazi Germany. And although he says, oh, I just did it because it was the thing to do, you know, I'm sorry, if the organisation was started by a guy who was an ex-SS officer, then I think, you know, it's another reason to raise questions about their integrity. You know, there's thousands of reasons to do it, but that's a key one. Another person who was involved right in the very start was a guy called Joseph Rettinger. He was the assistant to General Sikorsky, who was the Polish leader in exile during the Second World War. And General Sikorsky was died in a mysterious death. He was accompanied by Rettinger on just about every journey throughout the war that he made, and lots of diplomatic missions, obviously. But this was the first time that Rettinger hadn't been with him, said goodbye to him in Gibraltar. And as Sikorsky's plane took off, there was some sort of engine trouble or something, and it ditched. Whilst the pilot survived, Sikorsky died. Many people think that this was because Roosevelt and Stalin had cut a deal over Europe, and that Poland was going to go on to over to the Russian side, and that Sikorsky wasn't going to have this, so he had to be dispatched. Now, Rettinger, it's also come out in Stephen Dorrell's History of MI6 that Rettinger was definitely working for MI6 at the time. So here we've got a dodgy MI6 agent who's just stabbed somebody in the back, at least been possibly involved in all that, and an ex-SS officer starting an organisation. So, but the ultimate aim of it is really difficult to tell. I mean, if you look at it depends how you look at the Second World War and what that was all about, because it does seem to me that there was some tremendous power shifts during World War II. It really was the end of, beginning of the end, shall we say, of the British Empire, British power in the world. And, you know, in many respects, that was a good thing. But the Americans have kind of come in and dominated since then. And they were able to, let's not kid ourselves that the Americans came and rescued us in World War II. It wasn't the Americans or the British that beat the Nazis. It was the Russians. At Stalingrad, there were many more millions of Russians that died in the Second World War, defeating Hitler. And actually, Hitler was very much more anti-communist than he was anti-British. In fact, he had a lot of sympathy in Britain. And so the Second World War is key in understanding what Bilderberg was all about, because and its relationship to NATO, which emerged from that. Because, there was an SS Panzer Corps General, Paul Hauser, maybe he was an Uberfuhrer or some sort, one of these German ranks, but anyway, Paul Hauser, after the Second World War had finished, said that NATO had been formed from the international brigades of the SS. So that is to say that the original representatives of NATO were people who had been SS sympathisers in the Western world during the war. So, I mean, if this is true, and, you know, there's no reason why Hauser should lie about this. He was kind of bragging, saying, look, NATO is really, you know, very German, and we have kind of continued on through and into NATO. And, of course, you know, we have to remember things like Operation Paperclip, too, where the CIA came into Nazi Germany, and whilst the Nuremberg trials were being prepared and actually going on, they were springing Nazis from the jails and taking them over to the United States. Because they were, you know, for example, people who had been doing experiments on people, who they wanted their expertise and their knowledge to be brought over to the US to use in their military. Operation Paperclip, they were all, you know, many of these people who were very serious war criminals were sprung from jail in Germany, brought some of them via Wimbledon, bizarrely. But if anyone wants to look into Operation Paperclip, you'll see that that many of the ex-Nazis went to the United States, and some were given new names, were protected by the Americans. Many obviously went to South America too, but a lot of them ended up just simply working for organisations like NASA. So looking at sort of what is Bilderberg all about, I would say it's actually part of some kind of plan for world domination, and I think we can see that happening today in many of the policies of the Project for the New American Century. And there's a book, The Grand Chessboard, by I can never quite pronounce it, for Zbigniew Brzezinski, which came out before 9/11, which talked about that the America needed a new Pearl Harbor to have this excuse to kind of expand around the world. And of course, America had been intervening in countries around the world ever since the end of the Second World War. I mean, obviously, Vietnam was just one of the most obvious places, but they've been very, very busy intervening in countries around the world. We had Korea, many other places, the Americas, and there's a massive list. William Bloom wrote a book all about that, you know, saying just how many countries the Americans have been intervening in the Second World War. So I see Bilderberg as is really a very powerful political, involving royalty too, way of pushing that plan for world domination forward in the world today.
What stops a person just walking up to these venues where they're having these meetings? How do they keep the public away?
Well, they keep the public and the press away through secrecy. This is the main reason. I mean, I talked earlier on about press releases, right? Well, those press releases, they go out as the conference finishes. So if the press actually get onto the conference, they can still very often be told, well, we can't tell you who's there until everyone's gone. And they're asked to keep all of the names confidential for reasons of national security. Now, when does national security clash with the public interest? And I think if there is some kind of very, very powerful meeting going on, then people need to know about it. So there's nothing really to stop anybody going along to one of these meetings, maybe filming people as they're going in, filming people as they're going out, and doing basic journalistic work. Quite often, in the country where the meeting happens, there can be quite a bit of publicity. I mean, for example, in Canada last year, it was on the national television, etc. But generally speaking, it's only in the country where the meeting takes place that there's any publicity at all. And it's an item on the news that you might think, what the hell's that about? You know, and never see any more about it again. So maybe a little blip on the radar. But there are many more people around the world now who are taking an interest in Bilderberg conferences, at least via the internet, scrutinising what they do and forming their own conclusions about whether these people can be trusted and whether what they're doing is actually benevolent or not, or malicious.
I imagine they have an awful lot of security, because I heard that certain areas that they have to meet has to be 4 or 5-star hotel, isolated by a golf course, preferably, so that they could keep a perimeter. But who would be the kind of the security? Which country would they come from?
Well, the meetings that I've been to, it seems to be mostly CIA or some kind of American, maybe private American. It's difficult to tell who these people. They won't tell you who they are, you know. But it's always the Secret Service of the nation where the meeting's taking place. Which does make you question this whole Bilderberg spin about it being just a private meeting. You know, this is just a little private gathering of friends. Well, hang on. How come the taxpayer's picking up the security bill and you've got your Secret Service men, special branch, or surrounding the place? And, I mean, this happens at all of the meetings. So there is this kind of hypocrisy about the whole thing, where they are trying to spin it as something which is just an innocent private meeting. And actually, of course, it is something which seems very official. I remember when John Ronson went to this meeting in Sintra in Portugal, he phoned up the British Embassy because he was being followed and he was getting nervous. And apparently they said to him, we are just a little embassy. And what could we do with the Bilderbergs? They're much bigger and more powerful than we are. So, you know, I think that they what they do is, I mean, they're internationalists. So in a way, they are kind of thinking of national borders and national sovereignty as something which is really irrelevant to them, and we're above all that. But it is still possible for pretty much anybody to go along to one of these. I mean, I've seen sort of some people at meetings who were doing protesting of some sort or another. Also, I have to say that many of the people that go to these meetings, particularly some of the politicians, say left-wing politicians, I had quite a long chat to the Greek finance minister at one of the meetings, and he made it very clear to me that he wasn't happy about what was going on at the conference, and he had very, very serious disagreements. But you could see in his eyes that he was actually afraid of taking these people on, because, you know, these are the people that really run their national economy. You know, these are the banks that have the power to sort of see whether their economy is successful or not. So you can see a certain amount of fear in the eyes of elected politicians at these conferences, which is pretty worrying, really. So, you know, there's lots of work to do at these meetings if anyone goes along to them. That is just getting information from the staff of the hotel, from the aides, to some of the more public-spirited people who are attending these meetings. Because essentially it's a giant PR exercise for the US plan for world domination. And of course, I'm not just talking about the United States on its own. There are many big, powerful corporations in the world who are supporting this. You know, if you're looking at, you know, the difference between the European Union and the United States, really isn't that much. You look, it's all the same corporations that are in the driving seat both sides of the Atlantic. So these people are also pretty much one mind as to what they seem to want to do.
Well, I feel educated in a very short space of time. That's fantastic. I was almost going to trivialise what you've just said by putting my conspiracy hat on and saying, could this group also be connected to any other mysterious groups that maybe we don't see so much fact lying around? Maybe certain skull and bonesy Masonic, dare I say, if I really pull my conspiracy hat on really tight and say the Illuminati. These are all names that seem to be battered about when people mention Bilderberg. Now, I know how well documented Bilderberg is, not just on your site and on Wikipedia, and the amount of eyewitnesses and news reports in the mainstream, which, horrible to say, media. But so it must be true. But what about these other organisations, these more shadowy potential?
Well, it's interesting you mention Wikipedia, because I've been onto there and had a look at the Bilderberg entry, and all of the incriminating stuff is missing. Things like Bernhard's documented in his biography membership of the SS, it's not there. In fact, I put it on, and within about 2 minutes, pow, magically, it's disappeared from Wikipedia. You know, the fact that you know, Rechinger, who started it, is also been pinned down as a MI6 agent, that's disappeared. You know, various things that really make it look incriminating. So it's a kind of soft edge version on Wikipedia, right? Very soft. And then you mentioned the Illuminati, Freemasonry, all this kind of thing. Well, I was quite sceptical about that to begin with, but then I got doing one of my little trawls for Bilderberg, in fact done by a New Zealand friend of mine, he sent me a whole load of stuff over, and amongst it all was the CV of somebody called Andrew Palmer. Now, I didn't know who this guy was, just had a brief look through that. Oh, he organised the last Bilderberg meeting to take place in the British Isles, which is in 1998 in Turnberry, which Gordon Brown attended. And so I had a look at Andrew Gardner. Right, you were the guy that actually organised the meeting, right? You were the conference organiser. And there he is kind of bragging about it on his CV. So I thought, well, who is this fella? And I did a little trawl around on the net for him. And it turns out that he was the personal assistant to the Duke of Kent. Now, the Duke of Kent is the Grand Master of World Freemasonry. So there's immediately a very, very, very strong connection. Now, it may be coincidence that Andrew Palmer was chosen to organise the meeting, but it does link it in, totally link it in with World Freemasonry. Now, many people are suspicious of Freemasonry for all sorts of very good reasons, that really it's a kind of religious cult, and that people join it for privilege and promotion. It's not really, you know, it's supposed to be a charitable organisation. And actually, the character of Freemasonry has changed massively over the years. I think it's fair to say, if you go back to the 1700s, that Freemasonry was really something which was benevolent, sort of a bit like something more like the Rotary or the Lions or something, which was much more open. And that it was generally a sort of Christian organisation. You know, you had to believe in God to be a member of it, all this kind of thing. And then you have to believe in the afterlife, or say you do. You know, I don't know if people really do, but they've got to say that in order to join. And my feeling is that most people join it for some kind of many people join it for some kind of ulterior motive, that they're thinking that actually this is the in crowd. If I get in with the in crowd, I can, you know, sort of get a better job. I can network better with people, etc. I mean, I've personally witnessed developers talking to Freemasons about planning permission using Masonic language, little expressions like "on the level," which is you know, "no, we won't talk about it here, let's talk about it on the level," and my ears prick up, and I'm like, gosh, that's an interesting expression you just used. You're saying, don't talk about it here, wait till we get behind the lodge door and we'll talk about it there, about whether you're going to get your planning permission or not. Yeah, so yeah, there's all sorts of reasons why I think, you know, people were quite rightly suspicious of Freemasonry, but particularly because the character, as I said, has changed over the years. Now, the Illuminati is an organisation which is talked about, well, like when there's a tsunami, oh, it must have been the Illuminati. When there's an earthquake in Kent, oh, that would probably be the Illuminati organising that with a special sort of underground earthquake bomb, you know. So people basically talk about the Illuminati in a very blasé fashion as natural disasters or any kind of disaster. Oh, that must be them, you know, which I find just actually pretty stupid. But there is an organisation, or certainly was an organisation called the Illuminati, who were set up by Adam Weishaupt in Germany, in Bavaria, in the 1770s. And that organisation was designed specifically to infiltrate Freemasonry and to turn it into an organisation which, in his own words, would one day rule the world. So, you know, we're starting to talk about a similar kind of thing. So, the Illuminati today, do they exist? Don't they exist? Well, it's almost immaterial. You can see that there is a force in the world which is doing basically two things the Illuminati was set up to do very clearly and very specifically. One is to destroy all religions, and the other is to destroy all national governments. The idea was basically to infiltrate governments and religions, and to all of the leaders of those governments and religions, that is to say, everything from royalty down through to prime ministers, cabinet members, etc., that they were going to be surrounded by these people who are part of this secret society and cut off from the outside world. In other words, to exclude ordinary members of the public from access to leaders, no matter what, you know, how important somebody's need to communicate with their leader might be, that the Illuminati would exclude them and influence those leaders too. Now, the other thing the Illuminati were very, very keen on right from the start was taking over printing presses, taking over the press. And, you know, some might say that that's why the big media corporations are so well featured at these meetings. You know, some of the real big bosses are there from the biggest of the big media corporations. So it does look as if, you know, we may be dealing with something like that, especially because Freemasonry has now been so totally changed by this infiltration of the Illuminati since the 1770s, which has happened very, very gradually. And this connection with Andrew Palmer, you know, as the personal assistant to the head of World Freemasonry and the organiser of the Bilderberg meeting, I think you have to be a pretty credulous person to say, well, there really is no connection there. I've just, for the first time this year, and it has been hacked a few times, which I'm talking to the police about, I've just set up a, actually it was the end of last year, set up a forum for users, any internet user, to register on the forum and help kind of discover where the venue is going to be, which it does look like we've discovered this year. Never can be 100% sure. And really just get the dates sorted out so that at least we can make a stab at being at the right place. Now, I can tell you, both of the meetings I've been to so far, you know, you think that the meeting might take place, but you're never really sure. It's like when Thursday lunchtime comes and you're looking, is it all starting yet or not? You're never sure when you come round the corner to the hotel if you're going to be, there's going to be loads of black limousines, or it's just going to be a normal day. The birds will be tweeting, you know, and you've been given a bum steer. So there is that kind of element of excitement. And I can remember the first meeting, we came round the corner and everything looked the same. So, oh no, hang on a minute. There's a marquee being set up there. And the marquee was set up so that all of the these black Mercedes could come in with their tinted windows into the marquee, and the people could get out in the marquee and not be photographed. Actually, as it happened, it was quite a windy day and the marquee doors were flapping around, so you could actually get quite a good shot inside. And we managed to identify quite a few people who were going in and out. But that's another one bizarre thing for me, is many of these people, even though they're so powerful, are not exactly household names, yeah. So you're talking about, I mean, if someone was to say, okay, who's the boss of the IMF? You know, most people wouldn't even know. Certainly wouldn't know what he looked like, even though he's one of the most powerful men on earth. So, you know, this is one of the things which is always a little bit awkward, is trying to identify people. Now, if for example, one of the major people in Britain, well, the main British representative of Bilderberg, who's on the steering committee, is Kenneth Clark. Kenneth Clark, you might say, well, you know, why him? Well, he's a major figure in the British corporate world. You know, the big corporations. He's a director of, I don't know if he still is, I ought to check that, but he certainly was one of the directors of British American Tobacco, one of the big tobacco companies. He was also health minister under Thatcher, who famously, his first appearance, went down to have a photo call at a Formula One, as health minister, can you believe this? A Formula One car race, and he appeared sitting in a John Player special car. So there you've got the two biggest causes of death in the country, pretty much. One is tobacco and the other one is car accidents, and there's the Ministry of Health advertising both. So you can see there's a certain hypocrisy in Kenneth Clark, which and he was standing in the last election as a leader of the Labour Party. He stood many times and not actually got in, but you know, he is the key Bilderberg person in the UK. I mean, I've spoken to the guy, you know, but you just get a sense that they're completely disconnected from the consequences of their actions. I actually had a chat in the gardens of the Palace of Versailles with David Rockefeller. One of the Swedish photographers pointed him out to me. I think that might be Rockefeller. When I had a chat with him. And, you know, these people come across as very mild-mannered, nice, you know, sort of almost like your old granddad kind of character. But the problem comes when you're looking at the consequences of your actions. And I think this is the main problem with these kinds of capitalists, is that they are so disconnected from the decisions that they make in these big corporations, and they actually just don't care about people. All they really care about is profit. They care about their company generating more income and them getting more power as a result. And of course, when you come to the sort of state of wealth of someone like Rockefeller, absolutely uncountable amount of money. I mean, he's, you know, he doesn't want to buy another yacht with it, you know what I mean? He's got plenty of dosh. What he does is he starts looking at whereabouts that money can buy him influence. And the two main places that that money buys influence are surely the press. So by taking over television stations, satellite networks, newspapers, etc., that's going to buy him influence. And the other places are democratic institutions like Parliament and all democratic institutions around the world. So that's where these people focus their energies, is on influencing democratic institutions and the press. So, but these, unfortunately, are really the only two safeguards that ordinary members of the public, ordinary people, have for their rights. And at what's happening over the years is more and more of those rights, more and more of people's liberties are being taken away. It's like, it was described by somebody I saw on a film called George Orwell Rolls in His Grave, which I saw recently as a DVD. There's a guy that gives a speech in that saying that, imagine if you're going to a barbecue and there's a whole bunch of guests there, and there's a, you know, a little bit of food for each guest, and somebody turns up at the barbecue and grabs all except one of the pieces of chicken for themselves, puts it in a little bag and puts it in their pocket. I mean, this is essentially what we're talking about, is people like Rockefeller have such a vast amount of wealth, and so many people around the world. Thankfully, we've got a reasonable welfare state in Britain, but most of the world is not in that situation. And so many people around the world have got so little. It just seems to me this is not the kind of capitalism that was characteristic of years ago. It's a kind of new, very cold thing, where really people like Rockefeller are looking at the poor around the world and thinking, well, why should I care about them? And I think we need to be really concerned about the rise of corporate power for just that reason, because actually they don't care about anybody else, and that all they really care about is their profits and people serving their needs. And it's a kind of rise of a sort of creeping rise of a totalitarian type of system. And these people are looking at all sorts of ways to consolidate their power and consolidate their wealth. And I think, you know, all around the world there are many people now who are questioning this and trying to make sure that there is a better redistribution of wealth, because actually there's plenty in the world to go around. And this is one of the other things that many of these right-wing, you know, neoconservatives are, and royalty, I mean, we've had this sort of thing from the Duke of Edinburgh, for example, is they're into population control, they're into population reduction. They believe there's far too many people on planet Earth, and that is the source of the world's problems. Well, I can tell you it's not. What is the problem is the distribution of wealth and the way that the Western financial system and debt is leading third world countries of the South into terrible conditions of poverty. So, you know, there is plenty of wealth to go around and plenty of land to go around. And as I'm afraid, if anyone's starting to talk about population control, then this is going into the realms of fascism and eugenics, and I want nothing to do with it. And if anyone is going to be the first to volunteer to jump off a cliff to reduce the world's population, it's going to be them.
Should anyone want to go and check out this year's Bilderberg meeting firsthand, where would they have to go then?
Well, as I say, I mean, because the meeting hasn't happened yet, we're never 100% sure, but it does look increasingly likely that it's going to be in Turkey. It was one of the Turkish journalists did say at the end of last year's meeting that it is likely to be there. But then we've had many bum steers over the years. And also, it may make sense. The Turkish regime is really quite right-wing, and the Turkish police and military are notoriously right-wing and draconian and disregarding of citizens' rights. So it's the sort of thing that almost the Turkish military would almost delight in, I'm afraid. And so Turkey's quite a safe bet. I don't know quite what coverage there'll be in Turkey. It looks like it's taking place right at the very end of May. I think it's the 29th of May, 30th of May, and just into the first few days of June over that weekend. So, you know, and almost certainly in Istanbul, log on to the Bilderberg Forum, www.bilderberg.com. www.thefoundersforum.org, and then there's a click on a link to the forum, and they can see exactly what's happening there. Now, a lot of this stuff to do with Freemasonry, Illuminati, etc., does link in with philosophers over the years that have looked at ways to consolidate power. One of those is Hegel. Hegel's idea is that you have sort of two, I mean, at least the political manifestation of his philosophies is that you have two major political parties, very much like we see in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, and actually they're basically two faces of the same being, the same body. So actually, whilst they are pretending to have arguments and disagreements, actually they're really the same. So this is a Hegelian thing. It links in very much with the presidential contest between John Kerry and George W. Bush, where even though they were supposed to be representing two different political views, they're both part of the same secret society, the Skull and Bones at Yale University, which is some kind of a Masonic organization based in a mausoleum called the Tomb on the campus at Yale University. So you can see that there's this kind of thing is filtering in, the Hegelian stuff. It does seem is being used by a kind of rogue network behind the scenes to influence politics. I mean, we could even see the same in the UK between the Conservative and the Labour Party. So we've got the political leadership of both parties, really both being into privatisation, right-wing, corporate control, in which case you don't really have a proper political discourse in the nation. There seems to be very, very little in the Labour Party which has got any kind of... I mean, for example, the Labour Party is supposed to represent the working classes, working people and trade union rights, and yet we have actually seen no improvement in any of the trade union rights. I mean, here in the city of Bristol at the moment, we're fighting for union recognition at the local newspaper under ridiculous conditions, which were there set in stone by the Tory government to protect big business and to protect shareholders. Nothing to do with workers' rights. And this is something which is being enforced by Labour and even rolled back by them. I mean, for example, the privatisation of the London Underground. This is something that there was a big consultation about in London. You know, people were asked. The Greater London Authority had a good look at it. And finally decided, no, this is a disaster. Well, Gordon Brown then stepped in and said, I'm sorry, but this is a national importance. I'm going to overrule you. You've got to privatise. And then what happened? Well, there's a company called Metrolink took over, running it as a private business. And who did they employ to do the closed circuit television on the London Underground? Well, one of the most dodgy companies on earth. This is a company called Verint Systems, which is almost wholly owned by another company called Converse Technology. Now, these companies are registered in Israel, based in New York, and Verint Systems is run by an ex-top Israeli army officer. And the company Converse Technologies in New York, which owns it, is, I think it's 60%. Anyway, it's got a controlling interest, so basically it's the same company. They are undergoing a massive fraud investigation in New York. The shares in February were delisted of both businesses from the NASDAQ index, so you know you couldn't trade in the shares with the approval of the Securities and Exchange Commission in the United States that oversees the stock exchange. And there's a massive expose in the Wall Street Journal about this business. Now, this is the kind of reason why the consultation was done in the first place in London into the, you know, whether the London Underground should be privatised or not. And yet, you know, it's come up with this ridiculous company that is actually clearly a bunch of crooks running CCTV on the London Underground. And we start to think about things like the terrorist attacks. Why have there been no CCTV images released of the four alleged suicide bombers in London? Why was it that there was no footage of Jean-Charles de Menezes and the police when they were... I would suggest it's because the people running the CCTV are crooks. And I think if you look up... Well, I know. If you look up what that company is up to right now, they are. And the icing on the cake, in a way, frightening though it is that the chief executive of Converse, this technology company that owns Verint Systems, is actually now on the run. He's a guy called Kobe Alexander, and he's absconded with $19 million, and he's on the run in Africa. He's facing extradition. There was a hearing at the end of April last month, 2007, and he's managed to dodge that. He's got another month until there's another extradition hearing. But you see, you know, the idea of putting of privatizing something as important, with 3 million people a day use the London Underground, we cannot hand over the safety of Londoners in these situations to such clearly dodgy businesses. You know, so Gordon Brown, I'm afraid, you know, he's been to these Bilderberg conferences. I'm afraid he's in the frame for all this kind of stuff. And yeah, the idea that he is going to be any kind of new broom is just pie-in-the-sky nonsense.
So do we have a democracy? Is it worth voting?
Oh, I think it's definitely worth voting. I mean, obviously, in the ruling classes, the way I see it anyway, both within the press and within parliamentary systems and elsewhere, there's really a battle going on within the ruling classes over whether they really do want to be an elitist and totalitarian ruling class, or whether they want to have some kind of humanity. So that push is really important, that people actually re-engage with their politicians and make sure that they're voting, at least when they're, you know, people have fought and died to get the vote, you know. Things like the Peterloo Massacre in Manchester. You know, this has been a hard-won little exercise that we can do every once in a while. And it is important to use those votes. There are some extremely good MPs around. And I think, you know, it's a question of, look, finding who the decent MPs are, bigging them up, giving a good old pat on the back, and showing them as almost like role models, because we don't, you know, it's like the media these days is feeding us very, very few good role models. Most of them is this whole thing of the cult of celebrity, which is really, many, many people involved in the media are really against this. And yet it's being forced down people's throats. So, I mean, I think there is a great deal of use in, you know, being clued up as to who be a good party to vote for. The Lib Dems are an interesting ingredient in all this, because they've really from the start been against the carnage in Iraq. And, you know, the con, I mean, it really was, you know, magnificent sort of, well, not magnificent, but massive, massive con job on the world and the British public, that there was the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And as far as I'm concerned, in fact, there are lawyers around the world that have come out and said recently that you know, these sorts of actions where illegal wars have been started, you know, really should mean that Western leaders are tried for war crimes. But the thing is, who is actually going to do that? Who is going to take them on? The only people who can take them on really are in any kind of, I would imagine, are people either within the ruling classes or the press and the democratic institutions. So we need to focus, I think, we need to focus our energy on making sure that those with integrity within both the press and democratic institutions are supported. Otherwise, you know, they get demoralised and they don't want to fight for us anymore. And it's like the naughty boy who in the class gets a kind of kudos out of tricking the public. I think that would be disastrous if we allowed to get that to go on without backing up those who would oppose it.
Well, it's good to know there's still things that we can at least do and aim for. I'd like to finish on that optimistic note, I think, that there could be a way out of it all. So I want to thank you very much. Is there anything you'd like to finish with, or...? How about recommending one book, one film, and one website?
Okay, a book would have to be a book written by John Robison called Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Governments. As regards a film, that's always a little bit difficult, but one of my favourite films of all time is called The 3 Days of the Condor. I have to add something to that because there's a TV series as well called The Prisoner, if people have never seen The Prisoner. So that's a fantastic series, The Prisoner, if you can get to see that. What was it else you wanted?
A website.
Oh, a website.
That might be obvious.
Well, not necessarily. No, there's lots of good stuff. I would actually recommend something like whatreallyhappened.com. Yeah, that site is an English language digest of news from all around the world. And anything that's like that, I would recommend. But What Really Happened is one of the best examples. It also categorises everything very, very easy to see.
Awesome. I'm going to try and put as many of those links as I can on the blog, which, of course, you remember as documentary.com. Almost can't say it. I'm that tired. It's right at the early hours of the morning now. I'm very much glad we managed to make the time. I'm probably going to stick this in one podcast and not serialise it. There's so much information for people. Pause it, come back to it, make sure you listen to the whole of it, because I've learned an awful lot, and I think it's very, very important that we widen our horizons to all of these subjects, all of these meetings.
One little last thing I'd like to add, and that is to do with journalism and writing, is in my experience, many people just simply don't have the confidence to do journalism and to do writing. And if you feel that you have a particularly interesting story to tell, or a good analysis, a good take on world events, doesn't matter how big, or even something small locally, please do just pick up the phone, get hold of your local or national features editor and have a chat. There's no reason why anybody who's a reasonably good writer can't be contributing freelance articles to newspapers. I mean, some newspaper editors are not the sort of types that listen, but if someone isn't really interested, we'll try again. If you think it's a good piece of writing, go for it. And if you think you've got a good idea for a documentary, that sort of thing, talk to the local radio TV people about it. Because there's only one way that an editor can really make a name for themselves, and that's by having really good cutting-edge material at the right time. And often that the people who are staff journalists don't have the lines in that that many writers outside and freelancers do. I always think that, even if it's only one article you get in ever, that it's well worth it, because you're sharing knowledge with people in the same way as we do on the internet. If you can't get your you write your article, you can't get it published, just make sure it gets out there one way or another.
Excellent. And I'd like to thank you for sharing your knowledge with us. Cheers, Tony.